The 1950s, America and Korea were at war. The space race took off with the launch of Sputnik. The Cold War was heating up, and comic books came under fire. With the threat of nuclear attack came the concern of radiation and its effect on life. Fears of a communist invasion, technological advances, and creatures from beyond our moon spread across the country. But worry not, my friends, for you are safe in the spoiler room with the crew. So grab your favorite drink and pull up a chair as they discuss monster films from this decade in It Came From The 50s.
Yes, my friends, it is another It Came From The 50s episode, back-to-back episodes this month. That's how much I love you and how much fun these It Came From The 50s episodes have been. And tonight, we are talking about one that I know one particular spoiler room crew member has been anxious to talk about. And yes, we are looking at 1959's The Killer Shrews. And tonight, to talk about this, first we have the diva in the spoiler room. It is Dawn. Hello, Dawn. How are you?
I'm just fine. How are you guys?
Oh, we're so happy you're here for this one. You ready to talk about some sharp, pointy teeth?
Among other things.
Among other things. Awesome. And next to Dawn, he is back from parts unknown, coming in the red trunks with the white mask. It is none other than Doctavius Steve. Hello, Doc. How are you?
I'm confused now because when you started talking about the sharp pointy teeth, I thought maybe it was the rabbit in Holy Grail.
The most holy man. No. Yeah.
With the holy hand grenade. Yes, that type of thing. Hello, I'm fine.
Glad to have you here tonight to talk about this classic film.
Absolutely a classic.
Yes. And Dodd, I would love it if you could give the synopsis of The Killer Shrews.
Okay, so it's a fairly straightforward story. Thorne Sherman, Captain Thorne Sherman, travels to this island to drop off supplies to some scientists who live there off the coast of Texas. however, on his way there, a hurricane is coming because it was 1959. They didn't have a whole lot of heads up, apparently.
No.
So he gets there and finds that the scientist is ready to send his daughter packing with Captain Thorne. But because their radio equipment and communication equipment was damaged somehow, they are unable to leave the island until after the hurricane has passed. Unbeknownst to Captain Thorne, the scientists were studying overpopulation by genetically modifying shrews.
Sorry.
The island has become overrun with shrews, and the scientist's assistant, I didn't quite catch what he was.
I have no idea.
Jerry the drunk, who was engaged to the scientist doctor. Why am I drawing a blank on his name now? Anyhow, the scientist's daughter. Cool. Yeah, he did have a name. I even knew it.
The daughter's name was Anne?
The daughter's name was Anne. Dr. Kregis.
There we go.
Yes, Dr. Kregis. Yeah, this Jerry the drunk was engaged to Anne Kregis, apparently right up until he pushed her out of the way to get away from the killer shrews. Save his own life instead of hers. Anyhow, so long story short, Captain Thorne saves the day and everybody except, you know, the people who die and Jerry the drunk.
And Jerry the drunk, yes, Jerry the drunk ends up left on the island.
It was about time.
Yeah. I have very mixed feelings about the opinions of drinking in this movie.
There's a lot of drinking in this movie.
There's a lot of drinking in this movie.
But,
and yet,
but Jerry's problem is not that he's a drunk. It's that he's a jerk who drinks. Those are two different things, though. I haven't wished somebody, you know, waiting for somebody to die so much in a film since some of those Friday the 13th films.
Yeah, no kidding, right?
He's just a jerk.
Worthless jerk. I missed the part, I guess, where they were engaged.
It's a line of dialogue. It's a conversation that happens early on in the thing.
So he was engaged to Anne. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was engaged to Anne, and then he's kind of roughhousing her a little bit. And he's like, oh, I take my engagement seriously. And she's like, well, so do I, right up until last night when you shoved me out of the way and left me behind to get attacked by those shrews.
I missed that one piece of riveting dialogue. Damn it.
See, Mark, you gotta pay attention to a densely populated film like this.
You miss
it subtle in spots. And as much as I know I sound sarcastic, there is actually some layers in this thing, I think. Not many, but
there are
No, you gotta pay attention because they don't have time to mess around. This clock's in at what, 68, 70 minutes?
69 minutes, I think.
They don't have time to repeat stuff. This isn't Shakespeare, you know, where they'll tell you 3-4 times or like a reality show. They just mention it once and they move on. You got shrews to fight. Come on.
Yeah, shrews to fight. Yeah, there is a lot of drinking though. You guys mentioned it. I noticed that watching it again this time. I'm like, Cripes, how much martinis are they going to be? It's like
all the martinis.
You could do a drinking game with every time they take a drink, you take a drink and see if you get as drunk as Jerry does.
I started to wonder how many crates of those supplies were alcohol and cigarettes.
Oh yeah, and cigarettes too. Everybody was constantly lighting up too.
That is 1959.
It was 1959. Yes,
they were all hooked from World War II yet. You know, all the K rations and everything. One of the moments that, not to get ahead of this too much.
Oh, that's fine.
Because this is not. As I've kind of half joked, it's a quick film and it moves, but there's some subtle gags. There's one about halfway through where Captain, has a drink. And then Jerry takes it out of his hand, finishes most of it, gives it back to him. And then the captain goes to take, and then looks at it like, oh, wait a minute, I don't want this. And goes and gets another one. And I'm like, but it's not like a big ha ha moment. It's just this little, as dialogue is happening, it's this little bit of business on the side. And I'm like, that's actually pretty good. Uh-huh. I didn't expect that. That's really nice.
And I'm happy to pick on this movie because there's a lot in it. It's been riffed by MSDK. Mm-hmm. It's been mocked for a lot, but it's really a kind of a pivotal movie. There wasn't a movie like this before. I mean, all the creature features, the science fiction creature features before this were like one slow shambling creature, tarantula, one slow kind of.
Or they're giants.
Sinister creature. Like or them. Giants. Or even Attack of the Giant Leeches. There were like three, but they were still kind of slow and shambling. And this is the first one that was a pack of fast moving monsters coming at you. I mean, the next movie that was this pivotal in horror was, I believe, Night of the Living Dead a few years later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So as much as we mock it, it was a new and innovative thing. Well, even if they were just dogs covered in bath mats.
At the plus side, you don't see them much, though. A lot of you don't see the dogs in the bath mats much. So a lot of them are these scrambling teeth and sometimes, they look a little stiff, you know, where it's clearly just something being scraped against a fence or something. But some of those shots, because they keep them minimized as if they know, okay, we need to keep this quick so they don't get a good look. I thought they were reasonably effective and looked pretty solid. It's kind of the Jaws effect. If you don't get a good look at it, you go, wow, this is really cool. It's only when you see the robot not turning that you go, that shark doesn't look nearly as scary now because it's moving slowly in a circle because it can't move. But
it helps a little bit too that it was shot on a lower budget, in all honesty, because you only have so many shots, and until they get to like the fence and they actually start acting like dogs at a fence.
Yes.
They do actually kind of look good, and they use those shots sparingly. What surprised me rewatching this again, and I forgot, we've watched a number of 50s monster films now, and some of them were pretty freaky in that, but I mean the crawling eye was a giant eye in that, like you said, these are smaller creatures, but the puppets that they made.
Yeah.
Those things are fucking freaky.
There's a lot of detail. Yeah, it's not just like a sock puppet with teeth. You know, they look really good, actually.
Yeah, when they go down to the basement and he takes on the one, which that's where they find out that these also have poison because it ended up...
we put out some poison and they drank the poison and they absorbed the poison. Yes. That was both a okay and a... Well, that makes them that much more frightening, actually.
Yes.
I get it.
But the
scratch you. This sucks.
You know, you don't really see it too much because they do a lot of cool old school, you know, haunted house type things where it's creative camera angles and quick cuts, so you don't really notice it too much. But when you are on there for a bit of time, like when he shoots it once and it picks its head up, it starts like, I'm like, Jesus, that's a creepy freaking puppet. Like that. That's actually pretty damn ugly looking.
Especially
you know?
In the black and white. You got a little bit you know, like chocolate syrup or whatever drooling. You know, it looks good.
Yeah. Well, they look good. And then you've got the scenes later on with the shrews. And yes, we're jumping around a bit, but the film is called The Killer Shrews, folks. You've got the shrews later on when they're doing the bucket thing where they come up with that idea of, we can get into Japan and we can shuffle our way to the shore and then get to the boat. And, you know, as they're walking along, the shrews are constantly around them. And the puppets got these big teeth and they're shoving the teeth through the openings. And I'm like, I'm like sitting here going, you know, for a cheesy horror film like this, I'm like, this is actually kind of an intense moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the whole movie really maintains a great level of suspense and tension, all things considered. I mean, with the puppets, with the quick flashes of the dogs, the music, even the set design is perfect.
Well, you know those
tension.
You know those Adobe walls. I mean, once you crack through that shell on the outside, they're just soft as pudding in the middle.
Well, like or that, or like the moment where they go to check on the boat when it becomes daylight, and Jerry pulls the good old drunk Jerry, just proves how much of a jerk he is by pulling the gun on Captain.
Yeah,
you know, it's like there's some interpersonal tension still there because he's no good. Man, Jerry's not good.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I'm excited now.
Yes,
go ahead. One of the other things I liked about this too. Is that everybody else is reasonably cool, except for Jerry. Because especially there's Mario, which is like, he seems to be like the general assistant and cook and everything like that. When the captain and Mario are down in the cellar looking for the shrew that got in, he's talking. They're both very friendly. He's treating him with a great deal of respect. He speaks Spanish to him.
Yeah.
Be safe, be careful. Yeah, okay. You know, cuidado. Yeah, sure, man. Everybody's cool. And I'm like, man, it's another little, just kind of delicate. There are a number of little delicate brushstrokes in this that you would not expect from a movie of this low budget and vintage.
No, the Thorne Sherman character, you point out a great point. He's our hero. And this guy... At first, when you meet him, he's not exactly the most personable. I mean, the way he's treating his buddy. I'm sorry. He's just, I'm like, wow, you're kind of the dick.
That struck me as this is how these guys talk to each other.
After a while, you figure out that. But like you said, later on, when you find out he's not, you know, he he's at first at least kind of like, you know, I mean, Anne is like, oh, oh, and he's just like, yeah, whatever.
you know, I was thinking, I don't necessarily, I mean, Jerry would be the closest to a villain in this movie, but you know who he reminds me of? And you brought this up talking about something else, Doc. Okay. He reminds me of Paul Reiser's character in Aliens.
Oh, okay.
That's who this Jerry reminds me of.
Okay.
The type of character he is. Very selfish, self-serving, doesn't really give a crap about anybody else. That's who he reminds me of.
Okay.
Wow, I think.
And then that makes James Bestar Han Solo, right?
Oh, God, no.
Okay, he's cooler than that then. Good.
Oh, God.
James Best is acting his butt off in this, though. He's so awesome. I loved him so much in this.
That man's got talent.
I love it. You know, especially just, you know, say, oh, okay, hey, look, it's Roscoe.
Yeah.
Wait, actually, he's really good at this. Because Jerry's played by, like, discount James Caron.
Yeah.
Well,
Ken Curtis.
What was he in? He was in what?
Who, Ken Curtis, the guy who played Jerry?
No. Ken Curtis is the producer. That's Festus from Gunsmoke.
Yes, Gunsmoke. That's what he was in. That's what Jerry was.
Yeah. That was Jerry, though, too?
Yeah, that was Jerry.
Missed that point somehow. I saw he produced it, and I went, that can't be the same Ken Curtis. And then Wikipedia told me it was. And I went, all right, I guess I'll believe this.
Yes, it is. That is Ken Curtis. He also plays Jerry.
Okay, in that case, Jerry was not, Ken Curtis was not doing his best work, because I've seen him do much better than that. He wasn't, it was a reasonably convincing drunk, but,
He was more.
Festus was a better drunk than that. Come on.
Well, the thing is, outside of the one point where, you know, where they wake him up and he's kind of wakes up, drunk because it was supposed to be his turn to patrol the house, which it's not a really big house, folks. I'm trying to figure out this patrol schedule that they had because you could probably sat in the hallway and watched the entire house from the hallway, but. You know, he wakes up and then he's got that kind of drunk on there. But for the most part, I just picked him up as the scared, paranoid guy. You know, not so much the drunk.
I like that. Hey, you go do my tour and then come wake me up and then I'll be fine.
Yeah.
It'll be cool. Don't wake up the captain. Screw him. I'll take him. It'll be fine.
Yeah. Don't wake up the captain for his shift. Take my shift, and when you can.
I like the way Mario is like, as soon as trouble kicks, he goes, I'm going for the captain. I'm not dealing it. But he doesn't tell on him.
No, he doesn't.
Another one of those little brushstrokes. He doesn't sit there and go, you know, I'd have woken Jerry up because it's supposed to be his tour, but he's drunk off his butt. So, and he's like this all the time. So I'm used to it, but.
Hey, Don, what'd you think of the other doctor who just like, appears and disappears at random moments. He's just
Dr.
Like,
Baines. Yeah.
That dude was hilarious.
He was. He was hilarious. He was very dedicated. A little FYI there, he's actually the guy that produced these movies. This one and its partner one, the giant Gila monster.
Oh, did he really?
And the movies were filmed on his property.
Okay, so he was the guy that was working with Ken Curtis, because I saw him. He was a radio performer, if I remember right.
Yes, you owned like 10 radio stations in Texas or something.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gila Monster, that was also directed by Ray Kellogg, who directed this film. And hold on to your britches, folks. You guys out there, those that listen, Ray Kellogg, the guy who directed this, directed The Green Beret.
And a whole bunch of Marilyn Monroe movies.
And a bunch of Marilyn Monroe movies he was involved in as well. It was his last. The Green Berets, I believe, was his last film that he directed, I believe, Ray Kellogg did. But, he wrote a lot of. He did the visual effects for. He was a visual effects guy, which is probably why the Shrews actually, like we were mentioning, the puppet. Were probably better than they had any right to be.
Gordon McClendon was the other producer, so he was the in a retentive doctor type fellow then.
Yeah, and Ray Kellogg did the special photographic effects for all kinds of movies.
Maverick or Ray. Oh, Gordon McClendon is, you know, he helped develop Top 40 Radio.
Oh, well, there. Wow.
Perfecting Top 40 Radio and offshore pirate radio broadcasting in Scandinavia and the British Isles. Okay, how about that?
There you go. That's Dr. Baines.
Yeah. See, folks, you didn't know just how pivotal this film was. Speaking of Scandinavia.
Thank you.
Don, I want to come back to you. Ingrid Goud. Her character, Anne, I compared to some of these other 50s shows, I just not sure what they wanted to do with this character. Was she the strong female? Was she supposed to be damsel in distress? I'm not sure. It seemed to jump around to what her, you know, everybody else kind of has that role. And her, it just didn't feel like they knew exactly what to do with her.
Yes. Everybody had their own little box to fill. You had your hero-ish, but he was still kind of a selfish hero. Yeah. You had your villain-ish. Mm-hmm. You had your mad scientists.
The guys who were there to explain everything.
Yeah. You had your... you had your token mm-hmm. minorities, who filled multiple other things, roles as well, with Mario, as you mentioned, and Rook. Mm-hmm. Rook actually would have been such a cool character. They started him out real strong.
Yeah.
And then he's nowhere to be found. He's like off screen, like ever.
Yeah. They started him out real strong, sassy, holding his own. Not in a subservient manner, which I love that. Mm-hmm. But then, yeah, you get Anne Kregis, who's bouncing around from strong female. This is what I want. I'm going to reach out and grab it, take it. And then she's kind of a wishy-washy, waiting for the hero to save her, kind of. They even have the conversation of she wants to be a normal, boring woman.
Yeah.
So it's like she's a strong woman who kind of devolves into a normal, boring woman.
She does. What I found interesting with the hero, too, is I never really... During the whole thing, and I think, I don't know if it was just the way James Best approached the character or whatnot, but he was like a guy that just had kind of a fleeting interest with her, where she seemed more enamored with him. You know, he showed some interest, but like, you get that scene, was it where they toss the bait, where they have the dead shrew, because they come up with this idea that with the overpopulation, the shrews are going to start eating each other, so let's throw this dead shrew carcass out as a distraction, and we'll be able to escape. And they crawl up on these crates, and so he helps her crawl up on the crate, and then she does this thing where she kind of leans up against him, like, you know, they're a couple, and he, like, does nothing.
he's kind of doing the, all right, everybody else sees this too, right? This is awkward. Hi, her dad. Oh, man. I'm going
to, like,
knock her over.
Yeah. Like I said, she starts out as the strong woman, and she's going to quote Grace Jones, she's going to grab him and take him. And that didn't work out so well for her.
No, because he just, because first and foremost, Thorne really just wants to get the hell off this fucking island.
Right.
Yes.
But had he and Jerry already had that moment at that point, or one of those moments? So he's kind of like, because some of it, he's kind of looking around like, this is not going to help.
Yeah.
This is really not going to help. Thanks, dear.
Isn't it?
He looked concerned, almost like, ah, crap. At least that's how I caught it. I haven't watched it more than once that I can remember. So,
what were you going to say, Don?
I expect Don's opinion to be more accurate.
No, I was trying to remember the timeline. If that happened,
I think it's before Jerry tries to pull the shotgun on him, though. But they've already had a conversation about it.
Was it before Jerry and Thorne go to the beach?
I think it's right before that.
Okay.
If I remember correctly.
Yeah, because then when they get back from the beach is well, they pull the gun on it, and then on Jerry pulls the gun on Thorne, and then they get into a fist fight when they get back in because he knocks them out.
Yeah, because that's when he almost throws him over.
That was great.
They're like, what'd you do that for? And he's like, well, he almost tried to kill me twice in 5 minutes. So, you know,
kind of
that. That was a great moment. That's what I love about the Thorne character. He like beats the shit out of Jerry because he's just had enough of his bullshit. And he tosses him over the shoulder and he's just about to throw him over the fence. And he like gets right by the edge of the fence. And then he stops for a minute and looks and goes, oh, yeah, there's other people here.
That's some of it, but I think it breaks him out of that heated moment, though, too, where he's just mad. And then he goes, okay, no, this is not what I want to do.
His air punches. Because
there were one of the, yeah, no, a couple of those were a little airy, yeah. But by and large, he biffed him up pretty good.
Yes, he did.
He backhanded him a couple of times, too, when he was, you know, getting all hyperventilated and getting all panicky, and he just like baff, and I'm like, yeah, kick his ass.
Yeah.
Well, one of the moments I like too with we've got these main characters, but with the scientist character that we mentioned, one of the things I love is these shrews. And Don, you're absolutely right. The one thing that is surprising for a film of this type on this such low budget with a small cast, and you know, it just. It is an essential in old school independent B horror film. You do have actually a great atmosphere of constant danger that is lurking outside that it is missing from some of these other older films. You have that. And so you've got the one doctor who shrews ended up breaking into the kitchen because again, that adobe wall is just, you know, it gets soft in the rain. And once they break through that shell, man, it just can come right through, as Thorne reminds us three times during the film.
There was also a hurricane, a lot of water.
There was a hurricane, a lot of water, yes.
There was a lot of absence of water.
There was for a hurricane, yeah.
There was talk of water.
There was
talk of water.
Talk of water. Yeah. But water's expensive.
Water costs money, and they couldn't run the
retakes hose. Due to water take are expensive.
They couldn't run the hose all the way from the house to the other house. So, but he opens the door and he gets the one doctor, the minor character doctor. He gets scratched by a shrew, and he's sitting there typing while everyone else is talking. They're like, "Oh, what are we going to do about the shrews?" And oh, there's still four in there, and he's just typing away, and then he just dies. And you find out the dude was sitting there typing up the feelings and results he had from the scratch he got from the venomous shrew. And it's like you said, Doc, it's just one of those subtle touches where I'm like, oh, damn, that's kind of cool.
Well, he even describes himself as clinical. That yeah. You know, he thinks only in the, because he apologized. I don't remember what he's like. Oh, yeah, this and this. He goes, oh. I think it was when they were talking about the poison earlier on, because Mario gets scratched and Captain's like, I got the tourniquet on him. There's no reason why he should be dead. And then they go, oh, okay, there was poison. You know, these things are highly poisonous. That's even better. So when he gets attacked, he's like, no, I just ripped my pants. And he just typed, because he's like, oh, this is great. They absorb the poison and everything. He goes, I'm sorry. I think only in clinical terms. It's obviously horrible for Mario. Kind of like, oh, crap. Yeah, that's not what I meant. So he's just this really weirdly focused guy, and in a slightly different film, he'd probably be more of a comical character.
Yeah,
but he's not really in an overt way. In some other films, he'd probably be some bumbling guy with glasses constantly falling down and a very overtly awkward comical. But he's just there, just working the whole time. So that's part of what makes this interesting too, is that. He's very much a stereotype that doesn't fit the normal movie stereotype for that character.
Yeah. That's true. He is. But a number of the characters are like that as well. I mean, like we've all said, there's not a whole lot of runtime here.
Yeah.
So they really lean things down quite a bit. You know, and it's impressive for what they actually do for 1959 and on such a low budget. And the fact it's just this small cast. You know, they tell a complete story, but they waste not a whole lot of time throughout the script. I mean, it's pretty much bam, bam, bam. We just, almost everything seems to move some kind of element of the plot. I never felt like there was, you know, because some of the older movies, you get some dialogue in that where it's just like, you know, there's no soundtrack and you get kind of the dead air space and you can just hear the hiss of the audio type of thing. But here they just keep going and drinking and smoking.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of dead. There's not like this little, you know, we need to have this little 20-minute subplot so we can get this up to feature length type moment where you go, okay, here's where the movie just spins for a bit and then gets back to the story. This movie did not do that.
No,
I think that helps it though a lot because it does feel just very, like you said, just very boom, 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 and you just keep moving. It does definitely feel like a day or so.
And I'm trying to figure out if they actually got someone to do the soundtrack or if they just borrowed music from another movie because you have dramatic music pretty much throughout most of this film.
I'd be surprised if it's anything other than library music.
Yeah,
Dunn, it doesn't say.
Dunn, what'd you think of the music in this, though? I mean, they're just having that normal dialogue with Rook, and you've got this really dramatic music going.
Yeah, it was very. It was very intentional.
Mm-hmm.
The music was driving the tone of the movie. It was surprising how well they did. I'm wondering if the music, and it would be something to look at, which I'm not going to look at right now, but I'm wondering if the music, because they did this one and the giant Gila monster, I'm wondering if they used the same music for both movies to keep the budget in control.
Oh, sure.
So they may have been able to splurge on the music a little bit more.
Yeah, I could see that too. Doc, you watched many a classic film, kind much like us. But I know, especially you're one of the friends I know that very much follows some of the classic stuff. This felt almost like a music that you've seen even in early serials, doesn't it? Where you have this dramatic music, even though pretty much nothing's dramatic's going on screen.
There was. You know, a chunk where I'm like, why are they still playing the dramatic? Oh, okay. We're still moving a little bit with it. Okay. You know, just, yeah, cause it fit, but it didn't necessarily match the action at times. And that's why I think it's, I immediately can't find anything to indicate that, but I suspect it's just library music. It does feel like the sort of, it sounds like it might be from the same bank of music that they would have played on television programs at the time and things like that, where it's not specifically made for the movie. But you just buy the rights to that tune. There are certain library tracks that you tend to hear either in the same series or in, you know, over different series and different time periods where you just go, oh, I have no clue what that sound is, but I know that music. And this is what the music in this one definitely felt like. Like you say, it's probably, you know, if we went to the point where we compared it, we could probably find it in half a dozen other movies of that year, probably even perhaps. And I don't mean that to be detrimental. That's just a production thing where like you said, they probably licensed it for both films at the same time and got it cheaper that way.
Yeah. You bring up a great point, Don. It makes me want to, I haven't watched it in like ages, but it would make me want to watch the giant Gila monster again. Not that I need a reason to, just to see if it's got the same musical cues. Because
and again, it's just a suggestion. I do not know.
Yeah, I find it very believable, though.
I wouldn't put it past them. I mean, yeah, these are companion pieces. They shot them. They're produced by the same folks. They're directed. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing saying, I mean, that they didn't at all use the same music for sure. And that's not necessarily bad. I thought it was effective because I always liked that in like the really old movies, like in the 30s, you'd get that sometime where, you know, someone's just walking up the stairs, you know, in a house or whatever. And you just got this dramatic music played like, and you're like, nothing's happening.
Not yet.
But not dun, dun, yet. Dun.
Spooky spider. You know. Can't oh, look, there's a rubber bat. Oh, no, sorry. That's a different film, though. But would yeah, no, it, that's part of what that's for. And again, you know, if they use library music, that's not a bad thing. That's, again, that's just a production limitation. And if they used it effectively, that doesn't matter. The fact that it wasn't specifically composed for a film does not matter at all to me.
Well, in indie film makers do that nowadays. I mean, Derek, he'll watch an independent horror film. He goes, oh, I know where they got this music from.
Creative comment. You see it. We see it a lot when we're doing the festival. That's half of the credits sometimes is just where they source the music from. And it's all under a Creative Commons use license. So in that way, nothing has changed. It's just the method that which they would source the music has changed. It's a fine thing.
Yeah. I enjoy the music too from it in this film. I think it's effective and it helps keep the tension and also, you know, kind of fills in that spot when there's nothing really going on.
Mark is trying to find the vinyl of it now.
No, I'm not trying to find the vinyl. No, there's three soundtrack credits on IMDb with the titles Finger of Suspicion 1, Finger of Suspicion 2, and Cliffhanger 1. So this must have been library music.
Those are probably library tracks. Yeah. Yeah,
music by Harry Bluestone and Emil Cadkin. So yeah, these were probably library tracks that.
It's like stock footage. Yeah, it's just stock music. You know, yeah. You went to a place and you paid for rights to that to use it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean their production group company who, you know, produced it so you're going to get the most out of it.
There you go.
You freaking paid for the music,
and,
man.
Yeah, and they seem like they picked well. It's not like they pulled a, you know, like an Ed Wood where they just got all the music they could find. We're going to cram it in this feature. Look, I got some stock footage of airplanes. Where am I going to use this? That's not what they did. So
I got this musical cue I grabbed from someone. They played it for nothing.
I'll put it over, you know, airplanes going on, you know, the hangar, you know, the aircraft. It'll be great. It has nothing to do with the scene, but it'll be, you know, we're showing the military might of the United States as the aliens come. It'll be beautiful.
Now, we do get a theme in here because we've kind of covered, you know, a number of these 50s films now, and a lot of them have had that theme of either nuclear presence, of communist invasion, or the evils of science. And this not really was so much evil of science. I mean, yes, they created the killer shrews, but there was more of the message of overpopulation. Don, which did you think was stronger in this? The theme of overpopulation or the theme of science is evil? Or do you think they weren't going for either theme?
I don't think they were going for either thing. Definitely not science is evil, but science is dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Because it wasn't, everything was, they were careful to contain everything to the island. And if everybody died on the island, then everybody died on the island. It didn't spread. It wasn't a world danger. It was just an immediate danger. There wasn't an invasion happening off the island. They certainly didn't do it on purpose, but definitely science is dangerous, and even science for good is dangerous.
Would you agree with that, Doc, that this science is dangerous but not necessarily evil? And would you say it had more of the overpopulation theme, or did they just kind of drop that in at beginning and end just to try to, I don't know, give a little extra oomph to the purpose of everything?
Yeah, the overpopulation's clearly the thread that they're working through, which I think is in a couple other films at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if it's so much that science is dangerous or evil. Science will it's kind of the same vibe from Frankenstein. It's not so much dangerous. Science will do things because it can, not because it should.
Okay, Malcolm.
Hi, we're trying to figure this thing out. Should you really be doing that? I don't know, but we're doing it. It's kind of that.
Okay, I Ian think. Malcolm. No, just kidding.
Yes. Yes, also that, yes.
Fair enough.
Same thread.
Same.
You know, should you really be doing it? Oh, you know, it's working out pretty good. We're learning a lot. Did you really mean to create the mutants? No.
Of course.
Did you? Yeah.
Well, to be fair, they weren't trying to create mutants, well-ish. They were trying to adjust metabolism so that the population wouldn't need as much energy to survive. So therefore, not eat each other out. Unfortunately, they backfired horribly, but...
There was some logic about trying to make everybody half size.
Yes.
We need less resources.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you was brought pretty,
that was an interesting concept, to say the least. I went, all right.
I'm sitting there going, well, that's why these scientists are on the islands. All of their compatriots and their fellow peers are like, wait, what? No, if we shrink it down to half the size, you've got double the resource.
I'm pretty sure that movie just got made this year too.
they're trying to create a race of homunculus.
Kinda, yeah. Which again goes back to me referencing Frankenstein at that point, I suppose. But
fair enough.
Yeah. Because it's weird because there is that vein of mad scientist when they start bringing that up, but it's really just that moment when the main doctor makes that comment.
Yeah.
The rest of their science is reasonably sciencey otherwise. That's that moment where it's like, yeah, we have this weird goal. We're going to fix everybody.
We're gonna make sure people grow only half their size, so they'll make double the resources. And I'm like, okay, Thanos. Okay.
Well, as everybody, you know, in the last 60 years, we've all gotten taller and fatter,
right?
At least in America.
Maybe they had a point then to make people half the size and double the resource. I'm like, your houses would be smaller.
Yeah.
So that's less.
Well, if you walk into a house that's like a couple hundred years old, that's why you have to duck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What the average size, you know, height? I mean, not many people were 6 foot tall, I think, back in the 50s.
No. Not at all.
Let's see. I wonder, pardon me, folks, just for a moment. Average height of person in the 1950s.
I feel like I'm on Derek's show now.
Now you're on Derek. Average
height. I'm listening to people Google things.
So here you go. Here you go. Let's see. Oh, that's, I said 1950s.
Okay.
And, average size of an American male was 5'9.5". That was from in 2010.
Okay. That sounds more logical to me. Okay.
That doesn't help me. Google failed me. So I don't know how tall a person average was.
So I was going to say, I know at one point, I'm about 5'8", and that was average at one point, but that was like 30 years ago. So obviously, it's gone up to 5'9", so we got that much taller.
But still, but coming back to the point of the film is they're talking about shrinking people to do more, you know, save on resources, which I'm still was trying to figure out the logic going. You know, and it's one of those where they just kind of briefly mention it and move on. So in a film like this, you don't overthink things. You're just like, okay, yeah, you know, and then it's one of those where you get out of the house and you're on the car ride home or whatever. And then you start thinking a little more and go, wait a minute.
Totally. Yeah. No, it's in the context of the film. It's a totally reasonable thing to be doing. Yes.
Yeah, in context of the film, you're like, well, that sounds okay. Yeah. I buy their reason. Okay. James Best is cool.
Also true. True things are true.
But yeah, in general, one of the things I did like too was that it was, you know, it all in one location, and that house set that they built was actually pretty cool. It had multiple rooms. Though I don't think they actually went down the stairs in the basement. I'm not sure.
Is it actually, literally or figuratively?
Literally.
No, they did not literally go down any steps, no.
There were no actual base. The basement was different part that they built.
It's called a set, Mark. They were on a film.
Is that what that's called? Really?
Sorry. Some people get to build these things, yes. It was probably a whole different building at that point, yeah.
Of course, you know, Thorne was also an expert with the hurricane. What was it, that one scene that they had where a tree fell, and our woman, our sole female character goes, she gets a little scared, and he's like, oh, no, that's okay. If the hurricane comes through here, all the trees will blow the opposite direction of the house. And I'm like sitting there going, really? Really, Mr. Science?
He might have been lying to relax her. You never know. Just because he said it doesn't mean he meant it.
Well, that's what I kind of got, was that he was just trying to relax her. But I just chuckled.
Calm down. They won't land on us. We're fine.
He just chuckled. Clearly. When he said, he's like, oh, no, when the hurricane comes through, they'll fall the opposite way of the house. Wow, okay.
There was also a lot of false beliefs back in the 50s about how opening windows during hurricanes and tornadoes would equalize the pressure on the inside of the house and the outside of the house. That was a common belief back then that people learned or was false. But it's a thing that they did. Tornadoes coming through, open up all your windows so that there's no damage. That just means things are going to need be breaking your glass anyway.
I seem to remember that even as a youth, that was just dying off at that point in like the late 70s, early 80s. That sounds familiar to me.
I was just going to mention that, Doc. I'm glad you brought it up, because I was like, shit, that was a belief up through the 80s. When I was in early 80s, that was my parents, because we had that cottage in Delafield, which is in Wisconsin. There's a little bit of kind of a tornado type alley in southern Wisconsin where it's really flat in that. And down by Wales there, you know, in Delafield, they used to get a lot of tornadoes. And it was like, oh, tornado in the area. Got to open up at least one of the windows. I remember them actually saying that.
All right. Our old brains are remembering things the same. All right.
But yeah, I remember that. Of course, yeah, then you get older and then you're just like, wait, no.
Well, somebody explains to you how it works differently and you go, oh, okay. No, they didn't know.
It doesn't matter.
All is well.
It's going to hit your house. It's going to hit your house. That's all. Oh, my God. Oh, but yeah, so Killer Shrews. There's actually some really fun things in here. One of my favorite lines. I want to get a favorite line from you guys first, and then I'll give mine if you have one. Doc, if you remember for the dialogue, do you have a favorite line from this film, or remember a line of dialogue or a clip or whatnot from one of the characters? Do you remember it all?
There were some good lines, but I didn't write anything down specifically.
Oh, sorry. So, I know. I jumped that on you. Ha ha. I surprised you. It's
see fans. He has fooled me.
Stump question.
He has stumped me. The chump. Yes.
Don, how about you? Do you have a favorite line in here? You've watched this film just a few times.
I don't have a favorite line, but I have a memorable line that, even thinking about it, makes me roll my eyes, and it's the last line of the film, essentially. I'm not going to worry about overpopulation just yet.
That is awful. Yes.
Well, that he follows that up then with kissing the girl, like,
it's awful. Yes,
I'm not worried about overpopulation. We're going to go down below deck and make a baby.
It's very much it's clearly the end of the cartoon, because we have to make an awkward reference to a joke so that we can end on a high note. Yes, it's that. And I went, you know, everything else was really cool. That was just kind of like, yeah, I get it, but no. Yeah.
I'm like, dude, her dad's right there, man. And you're just like, I'm not worried about overpopulation right now. Let's go.
I'm gonna kiss on your daughter now.
I'm gonna kiss on your daughter.
And you're gonna have to pay attention because there's only the rest of us here, ish. You know. Sorry.
We alluded to how, or we mentioned earlier about how how Anne mentioned she wanted to be a dull woman, and for me one of the lines that stood out for me was James Best, because Captain Thorne's line with just after she mentions that, and he mentions, "I'll take a dull alive woman anytime."
Yes.
Yeah.
Because the alternative is creepy and awkward.
As opposed to an exciting dead
woman. And an entirely different film at that point there. That one, yeah. I remembered that moment, but I couldn't remember the line. Yeah. But yeah.
I had to write that one down because she's going on about how, you know, she's working on experiments with her dad, though she's not actually a doctor in this, but, you know, she's worked in his experiments, and she just wants to be a dull woman, you know, rather, you know, because she's had her life threatened, so worried about her dying, and he just drops that line, and I'm like, oh, wow.
I did really like that moment, though, because it was him trying to, like, take her mind off of things, and she's trying to relax, you know, kind of calm her down a little bit, you know, let her catch her breath, so to speak. So he's, hi, what else do you do? Why are you here? It's like, okay, admittedly, you've only been here on the island for a couple hours, but I suppose nobody had a moment to, you know, we didn't, otherwise, you know, again, back to a normal film, we would have had info dump at the moment, at the beginning, and we would have known all these things, but we don't, and he doesn't either. Yeah. So he's just like, so what else do you do? Why are you here? I like the zoology. Okay. So you're here, yeah, helping out and everything. Yeah, I'm here helping out. Okay, fine, cool. You know, don't worry about the shrews. Don't worry about the noise outside. Just talk to me. I'm calming voice. It's cool. So what else do you do? Yeah, that sounds like fun. Okay, cool. Oh, you'd rather not be dead. I appreciate that. Cool, because I wouldn't want you to be dead either. This got awkward. Please cut. Oh, the scene cut. Oh, thank God.
There we go. I had a scene cut. Don, how'd you feel about that line? You made a little comment.
Yeah.
Is it true 50s?
Yeah.
Dialogue there?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a bit creepy. And that's what just stood out for me. I know he was trying to console her, but I'm like, I don't know if that came out the way you were expecting it to.
Decidedly not.
That was one of those meant wells, but came out just awkward.
I'd like to think it meant well,
at least.
And the thing is, it's a error in writing, because there's no way that line could have been delivered in a better way.
Agreed.
Right? Yeah. Poor James Best. He had to be like, oh, how the hell am I supposed to deliver this one?
Maybe I'll just look out and I'll cut the end of this scene and it'll be fine.
It almost sounds like a John Wayne line. Well, I'll take a
I'd rather have a live, boring woman. Okay.
Than a dead, exciting woman. No, that's George Romero's movie a few years later.
Living Dead Girl is a French film, sir.
There you go. So I think we'll wrap it up here with Killer Shrews. It came from the 50s. And since it is a came from the 50s special, we'll close out our episode here with one thing that you learned from the Killer Shrews 1959. So, Doc, we'll start with you. What's one thing you learned from the Killer Shrews about the 50s in 1959?
You don't have to kill your romantic rival because the genetically modified mutants will do it for you.
Hey, there you go. That's some good advice. That's an important lesson to learn. And Don, how about you? What's one thing you learned about the 50s in the Killer Shrews?
Regardless of actual physics, if you tip several metal tank-like or stock tanks upside down, punch holes in them, and then walk them into the ocean, they will float.
Yes.
They floated good.
They floated good. Yeah, I was trying to figure that one out. They're walking into the water that so they could get away from the shrews because they established earlier shrews can't swim. So they're walking into the water with these cans, and they're like up to their necks, and the cans are just floating at their normal.
I am almost drowned now. Okay, we should swim.
Yeah, but it's like those are some buoyant metal canisters, so which they A-teamed together, so they like.
Oh, that would have made that scene better. It's true. I didn't even think of that.
That's through a fan cut.
They're
of
like, A-team. Hey, we're gonna cobble some stuff together. It'll be cool. Come on, Jerry, you want to come along? No, I don't want to come along. I'm gonna stand here on this roof. All right, fine. You sure you don't want to come along? No, I don't want to come along. I'm gonna stand here and look concerned for a while with a shotgun.
And I wonder if they actually had planned on using the welder, or since this was some guy's house, they just happened to find.
Oh, cool! We got a welder. Let's do that too. Because I don't, you know, because he was at first. He was like, "Well, we got to find something to, like cut a little, you know, make a hole so we can see." Oh, cool! We got a welder. I'll just cut a hole in it. It'll be great.
Well, I don't know where the fourth.
We got off. We found a fourth one magically.
Yeah, because they're digging around. Hey. They only find three, and then suddenly there's four. And then,
well, that too. It's like even when he's like, "We got another one of these." He's like, "No, hey, I found one over here." Okay, and cool. Here's a third one. All right, four will be better. Where the fourth? The fourth one just magically appears as they're tying them together with like 17,000 miles of rope. I'm not complaining by any stretch of the imagination because clearly. Main doctor scientist dude has no clue what's around him at that point. He's just like, no, we only have the one.
we only have the one.
Dude, I can see two of them right here. Okay, maybe we only have the two then. You know, we'll have to double it. No, there's three. I found a third one and cutting torch.
Yeah.
Okay.
Holy shit, a cutting torch.
Mario must have moved them in.
We're prepared to
save drunk crazy Jerry too. I'm gonna stay on this roof with a shotgun. You guys are crazy. You're not coming along. Hey, they're digging through. We got to go.
Yeah.
Bye, Jerry. I'll be fine.
You won't. I got my shine. I got my shotgun. I'm good.
He wishes he had some shine. It would have taken the edge off when the shrew started eating him. He got like three steps and tripped like he was and no offense, like he was a girl in a Friday the 13th movie.
That's no offense. I think we've made
that. I'm not trying to offend you. I know you're not.
Oh, no, I know you're not.
We've all seen them. It's unfortunate that they were written that way.
Exactly.
Yes.
All right. I appreciate that you understood the context of my comment. Thank you.
I absolutely understood the context of your comment.
Ah, yes. And I learned as well that when you have your boat tied up, that when you take the long boat out, you keep a rope attached to it, apparently, all the way back to the pier. Did you guys catch that?
That was quite the rope.
That was Rook
and,
was
and the shrews ate through it, apparently.
He was leaving the yacht or, you know, their transport or whatever, but he kept feeding the rope out as he was taking the landing boat. And I'm like, okay. I'm like, that actually makes sense. I'm like, that's actually not a bad idea. But
I think the only reason they did that was because of the hurricane, though.
Yeah, that's true. The hurricane.
Also very logical.
The hurricane, which I'll take that back. What I learned from the killer shrews is that an adobe house's walls have clay in the middle, and if there's too much water, that they're soft in the middle. If you break the outer shell, you can move through them like it was mud.
Like butter.
Like butter.
Well, yes. Adobe walls are like butter. You just got to work at them for a minute. It's beautiful.
Because they say that like three times just to establish that, yes, the shrews can dig through the walls. It's like, we're going to establish this. That the shrews
you dummy, we're not safe because these are adobe walls.
Right. Well, and there was no way they were going to dig up through the floor because the floor was tile.
Yeah. Right, because tile's impenetrable. And, you know, if we would have made this house out of wood, we would have all been safe.
Yeah.
And why are we not enclosed in tin? Then we'd be the safest thing ever. We should be in a tank right now. What's wrong with you?
And the third little pig built his house out of concrete.
Tin. So, yeah, well, you know.
There you go.
You want to be safe from zombies and killer shrews, you build your house out of concrete.
There you go. There you go. Words, all the way words through. Of wisdom from Doc and the killer shrews. So... So now this is the part my fine folks here on our show do have some stuff out there you can catch. Dawn, why don't you tell our fine folks where they can find some of your written stuff?
Someday I might actually update it. Probably in October.
You've got plenty of stuff there, though.
Why? What's going on in October?
But in October is more likely that you're going to find something exciting and new there once the Horror Film Fest season starts.
Hey.
You can find me at intheaudience.net and look for updates from the new Horror Fest in Oshkosh.
Yes, that's coming up in mid-October. We will definitely be doing coverage of that and doing our traditional episode, of course, with that as well. So, yes, intheaudience.net, though, great stuff. She writes things a hell of a lot better than I do.
And I think I even reviewed this one on there somewhere.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, pretty because sure. You reviewed this just before you reviewed the sequel.
When I bought the sequel. Love it.
The Return of the Killer Shrews, which just came out, was like 2012 or something like that.
Yeah. I just realized it is in the public domain.
Is it really? Sequel?
It is, yeah. It's in the public domain right now.
Why did they do that?
Recently, I believe. Probably maybe. After James Best died.
Yeah, I would suspect.
You know what would be awesome? Doing a commentary track on that. Oh, there is a commentary track on it from the writer director Fred Olen Ray.
That doesn't mean we can't do one.
It's true.
Or two, because we can do both films. They're both in the public domain. Then.
Fair enough.
Strokes chin thoughtfully.
Oh boy, yeah, we could maybe try to get Fred Olen Ray on the show
again.
Again, he'd be the second returning person I interviewed outside of a certain other individual, which I won't mention to avoid being hazed.
It's too late. You're going to get mocked.
I'm going to get mocked, yes.
Mark just wants to sleep in his bed tonight.
That's okay. We all love her, too.
Yes, we do. And, Doctavius, where can they find you at?
All over the place.
Yes.
Mostly in Milwaukee, but not always. Next weekend, I'll be up in the Oshkosh Neenah area. I got the. We're competing in nationals for Burley, for the Burley picks. So that'll be Friday night in Oshkosh. If we survive that round, then we'll go to like a worldwide thing. Here, think about this. Worldwide is in Neenah next Saturday. And I'm laughing because it just sounds weird. It's awesome, but it just sounds weird.
Wait, worldwide burlesque competition in Neenah.
Yes, that's why it sounds funny, and that's why I chuckle, but it's for the truth. So, like, there'll be people from, I guess, from, like, Italy and Japan and everything coming to support and everything. So, there's eight people. We're in the... Not to get too in depth into this, we're trying to speak quickly.
That's okay.
I'm like a assistant for my friend who's in the singing competition. I joke that I'm a prop. It's not completely true, but it's kind of true. She does all the singing. I die on stage because that's what I'm good at. So if I die well enough and she sings well enough, then we'll perform again on Saturday. Otherwise, we'll just be watching that. Otherwise, next Shakespeare's maybe a Shakespeare show. It's The Birth of Merlin, which may or may not be an actual Shakespeare play, but we're going to do it anyway on September 10th through the 12th at Best Place, 901 West Juno, and it's a free show. Hopefully you'll bring some school supply donations because that's the goal of making it free because in part it's September and people are busy at that point. So if you want to see some Shakespeare, that'll be a good time. And then in October, we end the main season with Scottish play and we're not doing a Christmas show this year. We're doing three Christmas shows over the course of weeks between Black Friday and Christmas where we're doing Christmas Carol Raw.
Ooh. That should be interesting.
Fun times. I hope so. That just got officially announced last week, so.
Well, there you go, folks. You heard it fresh off the presses. If you are in the Milwaukee area, check that shit out. Make sure you check it out.
We're fun as hell. Come watch us.
Yeah.
Booze, I was a lady last week. It was cool.
Booze and live performers. Yeah, there you go, folks. Come for the booze, stay for the performance.
Exactly. Thank you.
There you go.
I thank y'all.
Well, I thank my friends for joining us tonight to talk about this film. Hope you enjoyed the discussion. And now, yeah, just let's say goodnight, folks.
Goodnight, folks.
Hey, all my friends out there looking for more Spoiler Room goodness, then why don't you check out our brand new Patreon page, patreon.com/specialmarkproductions, where you can get access to exclusive Spoiler Room episodes and a whole lot more. You can also find us on Facebook groups at SMPRD and on the Twitter at Special Mark Pro. Let your voice be heard and let us know what you would like to see in the Spoiler Room, as well as just how we're doing in general. We appreciate your support, and remember, in the Spoiler Room, the conversation is fresh, but we do spoil the movies.